Hello and welcome to this week's dialect. Hello and welcome to Dialect, brought to you by the Bristol Radio Co-op. Hello to everyone in Bristol and listeners on Preston FM, that's 103.2 in Preston, and Birmingham Unity FM on 93.5 in the Midlands, and Radio Verulam in St Albans. On this week's show, our guests in the studio are Jack Phillips from Freebus, a collective of concerned Bristol residents seeking to establish the world's first major non-profit public transport group. And we also have Bridget and Simon, who are Bristol evangelists. We'll also be hearing from Kerry McLeod from local community publication Bishopston Matters. And we have a feature from Anthea Page and episode 3 of Nick Payne's A Nomadic Tale. Trevor Carter's our poet in the studio this week, and Jeff Sparks brings us another What's On Guide and Song of the Week. I'm Tony Gosling. I'm pleased to welcome our first guest, who's Jack Phillips from Freebus. Hi, Jack.
Hi, Tony.
Now, first of all, this sounds like a bit of a pie-in-the-sky idea. Free public transport. Surely that's impossible.
Well, of course, you're right on one level. It's not free to run a bus service. That much is clear. But I think it's also not quite as expensive as the current fares that we're being charged.
OK, so where did this free bus idea come from?
Well, actually, Freebus started out as a campaign group which planned on some kind of imaginative ways of lobbying the council and the government to provide more free bus services in cities. But a number of us in the group felt that probably since more money was being taken out of public services, that maybe this was an unrealistic ambition in terms of a campaign, and that would it not be possible for us to run a cooperatively structured and non-profit bus operator which delivered the service that we all wanted to see in Bristol.
So to what extent is it possible to do it for free?
Well, obviously someone at some stage has to pay, because as I say, it's not free to run a bus service. So there are three different funding approaches that we're going to be using, and the first one is kind of technically known as crowdfunding. So we've been building our membership base, we've been asking for donations, and we've been building up towards our startup threshold, which is £25,000, which is the cost of running the service for 6 months.
And do you think you're going to be able to reach that total to get started?
Well, we've been pretty successful so far. We launched at the end of July, so we've had 3 months, and so far we've got 415 members. We've got quite a significant amount of money in the bank, and we've got some fairly large organisations that are interested in funding us. So things are looking promising, yeah.
Now, what was it that really persuaded you that this needed to be done? Are you a regular user yourself of public transport in Bristol?
I'm not at the moment. I'm a very keen cyclist, but I think really for all the citizens of Bristol, whether you're a car driver or a cyclist or a public transport user, really the state of transport Bristol, I think, is a concern for all of us. Bristol's got some of the highest bus fares in Europe. Its bus ridership continues to decline. We've got 78% of households in Bristol who are car owners. And, you know, it's an extremely car-centric city. And really, of the large cities in the UK, Bristol stands out as being one that really has to have a pretty fundamental rethink of the way that it runs its transport system.
Right. So whereabouts are you planning to do this? And I understand you're doing some sort of trial in December.
We are. We're going to run a one-week trial in December, which will be in collaboration with Bristol Community Transport, who are another non-profit bus operator in Bristol. We've got a kind of ETA of April 2011 for the main service. So we're expecting really that if we can run a one-week trial, we can kind of get a lot more people exposed to the idea and a lot more discussion going on of the importance of reform to the public transport system.
Now, I mean, I'm originally from London, and I can remember back in the 1980s, the Labour administration, what was at the time the Greater London Council, actually stood for election on the basis of reducing London's public transport fares to zero. So you're trying to do something similar here, aren't you?
On a micro rather than a macro scale, but
they were trying to do it through the rates or community charge or whatever that or as that would be now.
Right.
But I mean, is there any prospect, do you think, of the city council, who we all elect to look after our public transport needs as well as everything else? Is there any prospect of them helping out?
Well, I think that there's a very real debate to be had with Bristol Council in the sense that they pay out about 4.7 million in bus subsidies. I should say we all pay out 4.7 million in bus subsidies every year, which is obviously going to profit-making organisations. I mean, there are cities in mainland Europe, which have entirely free public transport systems. The most well-known is Hasselt in Belgium. And for a catchment area of 380,000 people, so not so different from Bristol, their entire public transport system is run for £4.2 million a year.
So what are we doing so wrong here?
Well, I think the answer to that is complex. I think it would be an unhelpful characterisation to think of FIRST as making huge profits and as it being a real cash cow for them. I don't think that's the case. I think that, you know, privatisation came with a kind of promise that increased competition would increase efficiency. Of course, in Bristol, we're not seeing any competition. We've got 95% of all services being run by FIRST. We've got very little in the way of meaningful investment. And the results of that are pretty clear to see if you drive on Bristol's roads at any time of the day or night, really.
Or cycle. So what do you think of cycling? Surely we should be getting on our bikes, not on the bus.
Absolutely, I agree with that. But, you know, I think cars and the huge number of private cars that are driving on Bristol roads are a real deterrent to cyclists. I mean, I'm a very confident and experienced cyclist, but I think those roads would be a real horror for someone who is less confident. So free bus is really an effort to make an important point to the council, but also to say that we can take meaningful steps to move away from our car dependency culture. So if people are interested in what we're doing, they want to find out a bit more, they can go to our website. It is freebus.org.uk.
And is that a national organisation or is it something that's just based here in Bristol?
It was born in Bristol, but I think we're hoping, certainly if we can prove the model, which has been successful in other areas but not to date in transport, that if we can demonstrate that this model works and that there's enough public will, that people will support community-owned organisations in this way, that there's no reason this model can't be applied elsewhere in the country.
So can you tell me a bit more about this trial? Will you be using a small bus and where is it likely to be running to and from?
Well, we'll be using a customised 17-seater minibus, which is wheelchair accessible and considerably larger than your average minibus. The trial week is running on a short loop from Temple Meads station around Bond Street and Cabot Circus and around the city centre. It's a 3-mile loop, which is relatively modest as a starting point. I think we're very much interested in the possibilities of integrating between different modes of transport, and that really this is one of the ways that Bristol's transport is really falling short, is that obviously Temple Meads is a little bit out of the city centre. And I think this is just yet another deterrent for people to get out of their cars and get onto public transport.
Apart from the obvious safety things, what are the other environmental benefits of using public transport more effectively?
We've got a situation in Bristol now where really the city is one of the most polluted areas in terms of air pollution in the Western world. We've got 150,000 people in the city who are living in areas with air pollution that are higher than international health guidelines. So we've got a very serious situation, really, in Bristol. We've got reputable health figures warning us that air pollution is causing far more deaths and far more illnesses than road accidents themselves, which already account for thousands and thousands of deaths each year. So I think from a personal point of view, it seems to me that people have become so entrenched in their behaviour with regard to cars that really it doesn't seem like there is an alternative. And for us, free public transport is that alternative.
OK, so how can people help you? Is it possible to donate or should they maybe join as members? You know, how do we help?
Absolutely. Well, in our first, as I say, we launched at the end of July, and in our first 3 months, we've got over 400 members. So that's one of the main ways that people can get involved.
And how much does it cost to join?
It's £20 or £50 per year, depending on the type of membership.
So do you get the best seat in the bus if you're on the free bus, if you're a member?
Actually, interestingly enough, there's no particular incentive either to join or to join at the higher rate. Anyone can use the bus, whether they're members or not. There's no particular incentive except for a kind of community incentive that the people of Bristol, I think, have got to a point where they've just said enough is enough and we're not going to continue like this and we need some radical change, and free bus is that change.
Now, what about meetings? You've got meetings coming up. I imagine a few of you involved in this. If people are actually interested in getting involved and giving some of their time to help.
Absolutely. I mean, we've just had our big launch event last week at Hamilton House on Stokes Croft. So we've got another meeting scheduled for November the 17th, I believe it is, although people would have to check into the website to confirm that. There are contact forms through the website, so it'd be great if people would get in touch with any thoughts, suggestions, or if you want to come along and help out with any of our various promotional efforts.
Okay, now, could you just give us the website again and maybe a phone number too?
Sure, the website is www.freebus.org.uk. We get pretty good results if you just type freebus, all one word, into Google. I'm reluctant to give out my personal phone number, Tony, but if people want to get in touch, then the website is the best way, or they can send an email to freebus@live.co.uk.
Now, you know what I'm thinking is maybe if people aren't on the internet.
I'm afraid it's a very internet-based initiative at the moment.
For the time being, okay.
But, I mean, we do have a postal address that people can contact us on, and you can find that also on the website, freebus.org.uk.
Jack Phillips, thanks very much. A fortnight ago, we heard the first part of John Jackson's experiences as a regional journalist. He started working on a newspaper in Tamworth near Birmingham and then graduated up the scale of the profession. In part two this week, John tells us what it was like to be a sub-editor on the Daily Mirror in Fleet Street.
Tell us about your career in journalism.
I was with The Guardian when I was on the Manchester Evening News. I went to the Manchester Evening News and The Guardian. They were sister papers. On the Evening News, I was crime reporter for the Manchester Evening News and show business reporter and goodness knows what. In fact, I did a sort of in-town last night show business thing where I called at the Grand Hotel and the under-managers would say, we've got so-and-so staying with us and a celebrity, and I'd go up to their rooms and interview them, and I'd go to another place. And that's where I met Jimmy Savile. Also did crime in Manchester. I was a crime reporter. At those times, you did a bit of everything, which was marvellous.
Did you ever do the Moores murders?
I was sort of on the fringe involved with Moores murders, yeah. They were pretty horrific. It was a tragic time for so many people involved. And really, I think people are still mourning because they still haven't found some of the graves.
Tell us about how you came to be in London.
Well, I was quite happy in London, but I came down to stay with a friend who'd worked with me in Manchester and was taken ill while I was down there and was rushed into St. Thomas's Hospital, where I had a pretty horrendous time of it. And it was decided that I would be better off working in London near to the hospitals. And so that's where I came into The People and then went on to the Daily Mirror, where I worked for many years on the Daily Mirror.
Tell us the most exciting interview you ever did on the Daily Mirror, or were there so many?
No, well, I think the most exciting ones were earlier, really. Liberace was fascinating. I will always remember that. And you'd come in as a reporter, as I would be. One of the most horrendous was you'd come in your charcoal grey shoes. Charcoal grey suit and suede shoes I had. I thought I was quite a dandy. And they said, John, out to Winter's Hill. And this was a tragic story of a flight of Exide battery men who'd been on a conference and were flying back to the Isle of Man and crashed on Winter's Hill, which was a big hill on the way in towards Manchester, in a snowstorm. And I was sent out in a radio van in my charcoal grey suit and my suede shoes and got there and then had to climb through the blizzard all the way up to the top of the hill. And there was the wreckage and, you know, there were toys strewn around that they were taking back for their children and bits and pieces. And so I'd then go down to the bottom of the hill, phone the radio story through to the news takers at the Evening News, then go back up and do other stories of toys and presents and strewn all over, go down again. I went up, I think, up and down about four times and absolutely exhausted because I'm not a breakfast man and I was starving. And on the top of the hill, which was a television transmitter place, they had opened it up And I went in and they had hot tomato soup. And I had this hot tomato soup. And whenever I have hot tomato soup, it is now my favourite soup. And the picture of Winter Hill is there every time I have the tomato soup.
Were a lot of people killed then?
Yes, they were all killed.
How many?
About 20, I think, 20 or 30. It was quite horrific.
That was Anthea Page talking to John Jackson, a former sub-editor at the Daily Mirror in London. Let's have some music now, and we're going to hear It Overtakes Me by the Flaming Lips from the album At War with the Mystics. That was It Overtakes Me by the Flaming Lips from their album At War with the Mystics. Right, well, I'm joined now by Simon Farris and Bridget White, who are two evangelists based around the Stokes Croft and Gloucester Road area. Hi, and welcome to Dialect.
Hi, Tony.
Hello.
Now, first of all, you both describe yourself as evangelists. So what exactly does that mean?
Well, basically it means someone who spreads the Christian gospel. Full stop.
Yes, from town to town, city to city, wherever.
But you're actually stuck here in Bristol, aren't you? You're not going elsewhere, are you?
We have travelled, yeah, to the Isle of Wight and Ireland and all around the country, really.
Yeah.
And Bridget, with you first, what's the journey that you had?
It was a long step from being brought up in Ireland as a Catholic, not having any access to a Bible, and realising that there was a message that needed to be preached. Because having grown up in Ireland, I wasn't told about repentance. It was more penance. So I was always suffering because if you did something wrong, there was no way out.
So what's the difference between repentance and penance then?
Well, penance is saying prayers every week. And the more sin you do, the more prayers you have to say. But repentance is turning away from all that and being totally set free and giving all the sin up.
I find it a bit strange that you say, being brought up in Ireland as a Catholic, that you didn't have access to the Bible. That sounds very strange.
No, I never even seen one. But I was looking everywhere because I knew there was a holy book that I should see, but I didn't even know what was in it. Nor could I get my hand on a sort of a catechism either. So I was looking around to see if I could find this book, and it wasn't until years later. So obviously, having found it, seen what was in it, I decided everyone needs to know this. So that's why I started evangelism, because I knew there's a message in there. Because we're told to go ye therefore and teach all nations to obey the teachings of Jesus.
Well, don't you think most people do know the teachings of Jesus already?
No, they don't. Because on the streets we talk to young people, and it's a message that needs to be renewed in every generation and all the time. And so we meet loads and loads of people that's never heard the gospel. Even in Bristol and all over the place, and it's a new message every day.
So when you first meet somebody who's not heard the gospel, how do you describe it in a nutshell?
Well, we usually start talking about life, and they usually want to know about sin and what kind of a lifestyle they're leading and all that. So
this is just about the difference between right and wrong, really.
Yes, yeah. And they want to know, you know, about heaven and hell. And so it starts off in different areas of their lives where they're worried about or something. And then we're able to comfort them by saying, well, Jesus died for your sins. And if you repent and stop and turn over, you can have a new start.
What about you, Simon? Because you come from a Protestant background, don't you?
Yeah, only a very nominal.
Okay, so for you, how would you approach chatting to somebody who doesn't get the gospel and hasn't heard the message? What is the message in a nutshell?
Having done it for years, we've honed down the message and found what works. Now I just go straight up to groups or individuals. I offer them a tract, and then, as they can see on my front, it says Jesus is the answer. They know who I'm talking about. And I go straight up to them and I say, would you like a place in heaven? And they normally say, yeah.
But that sounds like a trick question.
No, no. And then I say, well, did you know that the Bible says that if you ask Jesus for it, you will get it? And then loads of them pray for salvation there and then.
And how do you actually go about doing that? Praying for salvation in the street?
Yeah, they do. And then they're jumping for joy. We've got YouTube videos of it. They're absolutely over the moon, some of these teenagers.
I'm sure not everybody is receptive to your message. I'm sure you get quite a lot of people who really don't want to hear.
Well, our success rate, believe it or not, was as high as about 80% of people that we asked were getting saved. The adverse reactions that I get on the Stoats Croft really aren't that bad. People reject Jesus, but they're not really nasty to me. Honestly, it's not at all bad, really.
Now, you're saying about people being saved, but surely that's not for you to decide. That's something spiritual, or maybe for God to decide whether someone's saved or not. This is one of the things that irritates people, I think, is when Christians go up to somebody else and say, are you saved? Implying that I am, and why aren't you?
Well, the thing is, the Bible says, whoever calls on the name of the Lord will be saved. Romans 10:13.
So what's your past experience of Protestantism, and why did you decide it didn't have everything that you needed?
Well, I think it started, I got spiritually interested when I was 24. I went up to my Protestant church, it was on Christmas Day, and I got the words from the Holy Spirit, I think, God is not here. And I started seeking and repented, as Bridget was talking about, got my life right. Started praying, and God started doing miracles and answering prayers. And then I met a church in London.
Okay, let me stop you there, because what miracles was God doing at that point then?
One time I drove into Guildford from the neighbouring village where I was staying in order to buy a book on sociology, because that's what I was studying at the time with my doctor. And I came home with a Bible, and I've got no idea how that happened. I just came home with a Bible and I opened it up and God spoke right out of it.
So now both of you talk about the way of salvation. What is the way of salvation, Bridget?
Well, it's like you're on the wrong road and you're a sinner and there's no way out. And then suddenly you see in the Bible that Jesus died for all sinners of the world and that he is the light of the world. And if you walk with him, you won't walk in darkness. So suddenly you realise you are a sinner, you need to be redeemed out of it, and there's only one way, and it's through Jesus, having died on the cross. So I took that way out. I know the changes it's made in my life and how free I feel and how ready I feel to meet my Maker if I had to, and how great it's turned my life over just by accepting Jesus, turning from the way I was going and just being redeemed out of my old way of life, really.
Well, surely Christians are sinners, just like non-Christians are sinners too.
Yeah, we can all fall short, because it says in the Bible, for all have fallen short of the glory of God. But we know that when we do, we have a great Redeemer who's paved the way, and all we have to do is be sorry and keep on trying and keep on reading the Bible and just keep on down that road until we get to the end of it.
Now, I know you do a bit of work with bullying in schools. Why is that a problem, either of you?
I think it's a massive problem. Almost everyone I talk to has got a story of it. I was bullied at school, verbally a lot. And I want to start an action group. I absolutely loathe this sin. You know, it's diabolical to put what kids are going through. And I really want to do everything I can to stop it.
Well, give me an example of something you've heard from a young person about it.
Well, I know a young lad from Easton who started school when he was about 5 or maybe 4 and a half. And he was bullied all the way through until he was about 8 or 9. And his mother went, but there was no backup, there was no strategy in the school to help him. And in fact, she never got any help and he was quite damaged.
Now, I know one of the problems is that the head teachers in these schools don't like their own school to be one that's got a reputation for bullying, so they try and manage it, don't they?
That's
so
right.
Do you think it actually was really damaged, this child? Or
yes,
what happened?
It did, because in the end he actually had to be taken out and sent to another school. And it, even now that he's a 14-year-old youth, I feel that he has anger issues and he's built up things in the past which he doesn't know how to deal with, because it's like affected his whole life. And even though he's in a good school now, he's still suffering from the after effects because he never got any help.
A nasty final question for you, a difficult one, I hope. Anyway, what would you say to people who say the Bible should not be interpreted literally? And maybe you're interpreting it too literally.
No, it should be literal. I mean, for example, the fact that God created the world 6,000 years ago in six literal days is supported by just about all the scientific evidence.
Well, it's not supported by the evidence of evolution, is it?
That is just a theory, and Darwin renounced it 6 months before he died. I could point, as it's the last question, I point you, your listeners, to a website if you're interested, which is called creationontheweb.org. I get their magazine, and honestly, every page from scientists with PhDs, etc., is full of scientific factual proof of what I've just said, creation.
Okay, so if people are interested, where can they meet you? Where can they find you?
bristolundergroundchurch@yahoo.co.uk is probably the best starting
point.
That's
an email address.
Yeah.
Any other way, like telephone?
Well, if you contact us on there, I will pass on our personal details.
And where are we like to see you wandering around?
You know me. On my last interview, I was called Stokescroft Simon. Yeah, that's where I hang out every day.
Simon and Bridget, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks,
Tony.
Next up, we have an interview with Kerry McLeod, who's a writer and editor of local community magazine Bishopston Matters. Kerry talks us through the free local publication, what it covers, and also how she got into running her own local magazine.
And now for our next interview, we've got Kerry McLeod here. Hi, Kerry.
Hello.
Hello. And you put together the Bishopston Matters community, I don't know, what would you call it?
Yeah, it's a community newsletter.
Newsletter.
It goes out to 9,000 homes in Bishopston, Ashleydown, Hawfield and St Andrews area.
And what exactly do you cover within the newsletter?
We cover everything local, all the local community groups, charities, schools, church work, all the local traders. And the busy Gloucester Road.
Yeah, so what is it that you do? Do you kind of prepare it all?
Yeah, it's just me that works on all of it. So we have some great people that write in with different things, but I'm responsible for the articles and the advertising and layouts and everything.
There's so much there, because when you said newsletter, I'm like, really? It's more like a kind of a Bible, community Bible of everything that's going on in Bishopston.
So. That's the aim.
Great. So, I mean, what kind of stuff have you usually got in there then?
We cover... There's great societies in the area. The Bishopston Society reports from the Friends of St Andrews Park, the Friends of Hawfield Common, updates from all the local schools. Great creative area. There's the North Bristol Arts Trail coming up.
Mm-hmm.
We've recently had some filming for the next series of Skins in the local park and on the Gloucester Road. So there's lots of things going on.
So you kind of consolidate all this community kind of information and events and kind of local gossip.
Post it through people's doors
so they get to hear about
everything. Yes.
Great. Do you think that, you know, people, there's a lot of community stuff going on, but people just don't know about it?
That's right. When I started, I thought people were sort of busy with their jobs, didn't have the time now to volunteer and put together these groups. But it's great. It's the best part of my job, going out and meeting all sorts of different kinds of people, ages. And there's fantastic things going on in the area.
Yes. Yeah, so you mentioned that it's quite a creative area,
yes.
Especially Gloucester Road. I mean, mm-hmm. That's quite a hub at the moment. So how much of the kind of newsletter covers what's going on with that area?
It covers... the whole of the Gloucester Road, to do the traders. There's lots of fantastic independent shops, a real buzz of the cafes and bars. I don't think you need to come out of the Bishopston area now. Everything's there for you. So.
Great. And so how do you deliver this for free then? Or do you
it's
have
delivered
to pay?
Free. Yes, okay. Delivered free.
So you actually set up Bishopston Matters from a kind of a template, I suppose, from another area. Is it Bradley Stoke?
Yeah, the original was set in Bradley Stoke, and there's now sister magazines in Bishopston, Emerson's Green and Downend, Winterbourne, so we're growing.
So it makes it kind of easier for people to kind of take ownership of their local area.
That's
and tell
right.
people about
yes,
it.
Yes, yeah. get fantastic feedback from the readers.
How kind of difficult is it to put a publication like this together?
It's a lot of hard work, but it's a really rewarding job. And if you sort of can be quite self-disciplined, you're happy, you're a people person, happy to go out and talk to people, then I think anyone could do it. It's a fantastic way to make a living. Yeah, it's brilliant.
Definitely. So you'd recommend it for people?
Yeah, it's great. I think if you've probably for families, working mums, it's flexible with time, with the email and things like that. It's great. You can work at all different times the day and night to pull it all together.
Definitely. So does it, in terms of like, it's ad revenue that kind of keeps
that's it actually right
going?
It's funded by the local traders, yeah, that feature in there. So you have to work hard with that, but they do really well out of it because people like supporting, you know, the local resources. So.
Definitely. And you have a kind of spots for like local community groups to kind of have their kind of space as well.
Yes,
it's
free space to all the community groups. Yes, and we make sure it's really filled, otherwise people wouldn't be interested or reading it. But the feedback is people look forward to receiving the magazine, and they like the traders as well because they trust the traders with the association with the magazine.
Definitely. And does it cover kind of more just useful information about the area as well? So if someone's, say, just moved to the area, they pick
up. It'll have all the sort of local toddlers groups, church services, fairs going on, markets, all things like that were included. We've got a community notice board and listings, so it's all in there. People send in their information and I include it for free.
Great. So regardless of whether this is Bishopston or anywhere else in the country, this is a great thing to kind of set up in your area.
Yeah, I would suggest it's a brilliant resource and could be set up anywhere, and it really brings the community together.
Mm-hmm. So we've mentioned events, and you mentioned the North Bristol Arts Trail earlier.
Yes.
Have you got more details about that?
That's coming up the weekend of the 27th, 28th of November. People open up their houses, and it's art of a really high standard, all different mediums from painting, ceramics, glass, jewellery. You get a map and you can just travel around Bishopston, Henley's, Westbury Park, St Andrews, and it's just a lovely family weekend.
So how long has this been going on?
I'm not entirely sure. Definitely the past sort of few years, and it's grown to over 100 artists now.
Mm-hmm. And so what other kind of events have you got coming up?
There's lots of Christmas fairs and things like that, which the details are all in the magazine. We've been involved sort of sponsoring events in Park Arts, where a great family day where there was music, arts stalls, party in the park as well. Again, just all good family events which everyone can attend.
But I mean, I just the more I think about it, how did you get actually started doing this yourself? So,
It's a good friend of mine set up the Bad Estate one, and I was working out of Bristol. I really wanted to come back. I'd sort of managed in the job I was at before, so I sort of still wanted some flexibility and sort of design element. It was design that I trained in, and I just thought, I'll give it a go. And it literally just started like that.
That's really amazing. So if people wanted to find out more information about the Bishopston Matters.
Definitely. Currently it's the Matters magazine website, which is www.bradleystakematters.co.uk, and there's links to all the other magazines and information on how to set up.
Great. And if you are in Bishopston, you will be getting one through your letterbox, presumably.
That's right, yes.
Many thanks to Kerry McLeod, who we spoke to a couple of weeks ago. If you'd like to find out more about Bishopston Matters, you can contact Kerry on email. That's Kerry, K-E-R-R-Y, at Bishopston Matters, one word, bishopstonmatters.co.uk. Now, we've been treated to Nick Payne's life story in a nomadic tale with two instalments so far. So once again, we can join him on his travels.
After our chastening experience in Italy, we limped back to Zurich. Gary stayed on there with friends, but I borrowed some money from my ex-employer Michael Erlanger and caught a train back to England. There I knuckled down to some full-on roof tiling work at a family firm started by my great-grandfather and gathered together some funds whilst I waited for a new passport. Prior to a rendezvous I had with my brother Simon in Poland, I wanted to work at the October Beer Fest in Munich, and I still had to return to Zurich to pay back the money, so time was a bit tight. An accident I had whilst playing the fool on site left me with damaged ankles, but my stubborn nature kept me going, and I duly made it to Zurich, this time managing to hitch all the way. Michael gave me a job painting the cellar at his business premises, and within 2 weeks I had enough money to pay him back, with a good bit to spare for my travels. On my last night there, I was tempted into a game of poker with some friends, high rollers all, and learned a very hard lesson. never gamble when you can't afford to lose. They all had much deeper pockets than I, and I stumbled away from the fray, a poorer and a wiser man. I hitched over to Munich, and Julie found a job erecting the striptease tent at the Oktoberfest, and thereafter to act as a bouncer on the door. The show was a pretty tame affair, and so the punters left feeling ripped off. Not wanting to confront a gang of well-oiled guys looking to vent their frustrations, as the show neared its end, we made ourselves scarce and hid round the back till the next performance. After a few weeks living the life of the fairground, I was solvent again, so wanted to be on my way. The friends I had made there were very keen for me to go on tour with them round Germany and assured me that this was the life for me. I was nearly tempted, but the open road beckoned and I made my way across to Vienna. That journey was one of the most beautiful I have ever made. It was early autumn and Austria was bedecked in wonderful hues of red, gold and amber. I had the time, so spent a languid week soaking up the splendour of the many exquisite rivers and valleys that lay en route. Lifts were relatively easy to come by, and I made steady progress. At one point I was sat at the side of the road, enjoying the sun and some refreshment, when a car pulled up, unbidden, containing three American women. I assured them that I was happy where I was, but they insisted on taking me to the next town. My traveller's code decreed that I never turned down a lift, and so I reluctantly joined them. I managed to absorb their friendly advances and shot out unscathed at the earliest opportunity. I have since reviewed that restrictive code. I made it to Vienna steeped in the beauty of nature and imbued with good feeling. I caught a train up through Czechoslovakia to Wrocław, a city in southwest Poland, where my brother and his uni friends had been invited to join a student theatre festival. I could play no musical instrument except the drums, which was Simon's role, so I volunteered to help out with the driving. After a number of performances in this ancient city of art, we were scheduled to take the show on the road around Poland for a couple of weeks. We visited Warsaw, Poznan and Gdansk, and in each place they performed this rather risque piece, full of Hendrix-style wailing guitars, bare-breasted female dancers, albeit painted up somewhat, and a social commentary narrative pitched somewhere between Private Eye and Che Guevara. I'm not sure how it was all received, but to spice up my involvement in Gdansk, I created a little part for myself. In this heavily communist port in northeast Poland, the audience seemed even more nonplussed than previously. So I strove to bring the standing observers more into the action. I found an old tin cup and roughed up my face and clothing with some dirt, then proceeded to drag myself around the floor, as if some crippled hobo begging for a handout. I think this weird performance alarmed the stone-faced dock workers even more than the bare breasts. After the last performance in Poznan, we were scheduled to drive back to the west. It promised to be a cold night, so Ruthie, one of the troupe, and I loaded up some blankets we had taken from the hotel beds. All was fine until we reached the frontier with Germany. The hotel had raised the alarm, so we were received by some rather agitated Polish border guards, a pretty scary sight at past 3 o'clock on a cold and frosty morning. They demanded to search the van, so fearing the worst, Ruthie and I came clean. Thankfully, the punishment was no worse than being told to travel back to the hotel and return the plunder, which we dutifully did. Needless to say, the rest of the ensemble, being completely innocent of our actions, was a mite ticked off with us. We were all in shock, and the extra travelling would place a strain on our limited resources. Simon and I had decided to make Amsterdam our first port of call, so the homeward-bound company dropped us off in Brussels. We got lifts easily and arrived in the European hippie Mecca in the early hours. As we rolled up, a white VW was leaving. A large guy was leaning out of the window, tears streaming down his face and wailing, "Goodbye, Amsterdam," as his departing lament. We were mightily encouraged by this powerful show of affection for this much-vaunted city. After a few days in a hostel, we moved into a squat just round the back of the main station. A long barge sat on a nearby canal, its deck enveloped in plants. a large sign proclaiming the Lowland Weed Company apprised us of the nature of this beautiful verdant covering. We felt very welcome in such a liberally minded environment. Life in the squat was pretty bleak, though. It was now November, and a small paraffin stove with its soporific fumes was all we had to keep the cold at bay. Most days we slept till midday or mid-afternoon. We had managed to line up some warehouse work with an old carpet customer of mine, but the authorities would not give us a work permit. Money went from tight to non-existent. We lived off handouts from two Americans, Rob and Liz from Boston, whom we had met at the hostel. Robert bought a fair amount of Afghani black cannabis resin. He had rolled it out flat and was cutting it up into postcard-sized wafers to put in airmail envelopes, destined for friends stateside. Every evening for a week, he would sit there in the squat and hold up one of these missives. He would feel it carefully and declare, "Don't think that one is going to make it, do you?" We, of course, would readily agree, and he then proceeded to open up the letter and we would smoke the contents. During these sessions, I had some vivid perceptions of my early life and felt myself to be actually speaking in childlike voices. It might sound strange, but the very real sensation seemed to give me a more substantial meaning to my life. It was to be my first experience of internal travel, a reality beyond the well-trodden path of external aspirations. After one such extended bout, I awoke to the sounds of fevered hammering at the door. What with the previous night's intake and the effect of the fumes from the stove, my foggy brain could not quite take in what was happening. There were half a dozen men in the room, waving what looked like toy pistols in the air and commanding us to get up. I must have been feeling unusually playful, for I peered cosily at one of these pistols, grinning inanely. I could not believe these pistol, plastic-looking thing to be a threat to me in any way. Reluctantly, we staggered to our feet and adopted the position against the wall, whilst the plainclothes police, as they declared themselves to be, went about their business, searching through our meagre possessions. After inspecting our passports, they seemed satisfied, pocketed the weapons and left without any explanation. We were left a little startled and in much need of a very strong coffee. We later deduced, possibly correctly, that following a routine inspection of passports some days previously, they had noticed a Czechoslovakian visa in mine. They put two and two together and figured we were gunrunners for the IRA, the Czech armory being an apparent favourite of the provos, hence the somewhat heavy-handed manner of the police search. Life in this psychedelic paradise was everything the brochure said it would be, but the open road seemed always our main focus. Simon and I had grown up surrounded by trees and felt our next move should be to Norway, to the logging camps for the winter, then maybe move south in the spring. We were up on the dam rack one day at the offices of the American Express, vaguely thinking of buying a VW camper van for the journey but also to live in when underway, though we had no money to buy one. After their European tour, our travelling cousins from across the Atlantic usually ended up in Amsterdam before returning to the States. Having reached the end of the line, their vans, no hitchhiking for these well-heeled hippies, were for sale. They were plentiful in supply and well-priced. Whilst considering our options, we met a guy who began to tell us of this place called Eilat in southern Israel, where you could work on building sites, live in a shanty town with other hippies on the edge of the Negev desert and make some real money. Brave the Arctic conditions of Scandinavia or soak up the sun on the Red Sea. It was a no-brainer for two cold and hungry travellers. We made a quick decision and in record time arrived in Zurich 24 hours later. We stayed with friends enjoying their warm hospitality and a bag full of the produce from the Lowland Weed Company. This and the wonderful selection of vinyl helped to liberate me from my rather traditional and somewhat limited appreciation of music. For the first time, I really heard the essence of the poetic harmonies on offer. It was a revelation to me, so I laid back and felt myself to be in heaven. Brother Simon, who was and continues to be my guiding support and inspiration in the delights on offer to a true human being, was pleased to witness my uninhibited enjoyment. I was aiming to borrow some travelling money from a very rich friend to pay for the 3-day sea journey from Piraeus to Haifa, so we settled down to many days of indulgent pleasure in cosy yet opulent surroundings. There seemed to be a stark absence of poverty in this city of bored, affluent complacency. Not surprising, it was to later become the heroin capital of Europe. We put our feet up and considered our good fortune as R&R after our bleak northern experiences. This respite proved invaluable in preparing us for the further adventures of the open road.
Thanks, Nick Payne, for preparing and so brilliantly reading for us his nomadic tale. More of that next week. Well, it's my pleasure to welcome back to the studio one of our resident poets, Trevor Carter. Hi, Trevor.
Hi, Tony. Good to be back.
Where have you been?
I've been to Turkey and I've been to the Lake District.
Have you been poeting Yes. over there, or have you just been musing?
Well, both. A poet is a state of being, you know.
Okay, but you have to write as well, then you have been writing, I imagine.
Yeah.
So, what have you got for us this week?
This is a topical issue. It's called The Penalty. It's relating to Rooney, who has been in the news with his tremendously astute contract. So it's about that. It seems like a lunatic's system when Rooney can earn so much cash, while punters who pay for his wages are all penalised for the crash. Absurdities of the free market, we are told, just result from demand, as most of its actors act blindly with heads firmly lodged in the sand. Some footballers' brains are quite puny. Is our Rooney perhaps one of these? Yet he does have an instinct for business, as those threats to leave were a tease. His commitment, it dips and it swerves as he serves the goal of getting so rich. He gets what he thinks he deserves as he knows how to manage his pitch. Though detractors may think he's a moron, Rooney knows what his skills can be worth. And while most of us think that it's all wrong, he's the luckiest bloke on the earth.
I'm really glad you managed not to swear there, Trevor. Thank you very much.
I did that just for the radio.
And have you? So have
I made an immediate substitution.
Fantastic.
But you know, people come to some of my gigs, they can hear the unedited version, perhaps, you know.
Talking of which, you are on Saturday the 20th of November, aren't you?
Amongst other things, yes.
I see written before me here.
Yes.
So what's this event all about on Saturday the 20th of November? It's called Strange Creatures of the Night, and you're one of them, are you?
Apparently so, yes.
What will you be doing there, Trevor?
I'll be pontificating on matters surreal.
And the idea is people are supposed to come dressed up as their surreal fantasy. So can we any clues as to what you'll be dressing up as, Trevor?
Well, I'll see how I feel at the time, really. Yeah.
I don't know quite sure how you can come as a Dali person, because quite a lot of them are sort of twisted with arms behind their heads and things like that. So that will be an interesting event to see just how people come as surreal.
Well, it's worth coming just to see how people resent themselves, really, isn't it, really?
Yeah. And there'd be quite a lot of poetry,
I'm intrigued,
too.
You know.
Quite a lot of poetry. Scarlet Rascal, Elliot Hall, Trevor Carter, the Bard of Wimmill Hill, Tim Burrows, Chris Hales, Rob Howard and Chris Beckett. That is Saturday, 20th of November, 9 p.m. till 2 a.m. £5 on the door. And the venue is where exactly?
It's on a boat in the harbour.
Called
Ferries.
Under the Stars, it says.
Under the Stars. It's that one by the steps where the ferries come in, right at the end of that.
Okay, so I'd imagine you'll be able to miss it. You'll probably be able to hear you. Okay, Trevor, thanks very much.
Okay, Tony, fine, thank you.
Next up, ready to rock, it's Jeff with the What's On Guide.
Thank you, Tony. Hello, this is your What's On Guide from Dialect Radio. Starting with Tuesday, 9th of November, the Swinging Utters will be performing with support from You, Me and the Atom Bomb, Caves and also the Modern Farewell at the Croft in Stokescroft, Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £8 in advance. On Friday, 12th of November, Devil Driver will be performing with support from 36 Crazy Fists, LVT and Idiom at the O2 Academy in Frogmore Street, Bristol. Doors open at 5 p.m. and tickets are £17 in advance. On to Song of the Week, and I present Surfer Blood. They formed in 2009 in Florida, USA, and released their debut album, Astro Coast, in 2010. This is a track from that album, and it's titled Swim. That was Surfer Blood with Swim from their debut album Astro Coast. For more information, you can check out myspace.com/surferblood. On Saturday 13th of November, Beverly Craven will be performing at the Tunnels in Bristol and Exeter Mews, Bristol. Doors open at 7:30 p.m. and tickets are £15 in advance. Finally, on Sunday 14th of November, Edwin Collins will be performing with support from the Kin Beats at the Fleece in St Thomas Street, Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £15 in advance. That's all from me. Thanks for listening. Have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
That was Jeff Sparks from the Alcatraz Psycho Ward, at least according to his T-shirt today. Thanks, Jeff. Well, that's all from Dialect this week. Studio guests were Jack Phillips, and we also heard from Kerry McLeod and Bishopston Matters, as well as Simon and Bridget. Our feature this week was by Anthea Page. Nick Payne read us a nomadic tale. Trevor Carter read us one of his poems. And Jeff Sparks, who you just heard, wrote the What's On Guide. Studio engineer was Michael Noyce. Producer was Michaela Dennis. If you'd like to listen again or catch up with any of our previous shows, you can find us at dialectradio.co.uk. That's two words, dialectradio.co.uk. And of course, on the Bristol Community Radio website, bcfm.org.uk. So it's goodbye from me, Tony Gosling, and see you next week.
I've seen the demons, but they didn't make a sound. They tried to reach me, but I lay upon the ground. I seen the people, but they didn't make a sound. They tried to reach me, but I gave the run around. I reached for feelings, but they didn't make a sound. They tried to reach me, but I lay upon the ground. So miles and miles of squares. They tried to reach me, but I lay upon the ground.